For Wednesday, March 28, 2007, we have a couple of public hearings, and then we've got several work sessions, and we're going to take the agenda in the order in which it was posted. So I will begin by opening a public hearing on House Bill 2133. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2133 relates to petitions for post-conviction relief. Oregon law allows any person convicted of a crime and who has exhausted appeal rights to seek what's called post-conviction relief, or PCR. In short, a petitioner is entitled to PCR if the petitioner demonstrates that, one, there was a substantial denial of the petitioner's constitutional rights, two, the sentencing court lacked jurisdiction, three, the sentence was improper, or four, the statute on which the conviction was based is unconstitutional. A petitioner has 2 years from the date of the judgment or from the final Oregon appeal, whichever is later, to file the original petition for PCR in circuit court. Potential remedies for PCR include but are not limited to release, a new trial, or sentence modification. Once a circuit court receives a petition for PCR, it conducts a hearing into the matter. If the court denies the petitioner then has 30 days to file an appeal with the Oregon Court of Appeals. House Bill 2133 addresses this 30-day time period. A petitioner gets an additional 60 days to file if the petitioner shows that the lateness is not attributable to the petitioner and that there was a colorable claim of error in the proceeding from which the appeal is taken. In addition, House Bill 2133 addresses a court's ability to release a petitioner with a pending PCR appeal. It also specifies that a petitioner must give notice to the relevant district attorney, both of the original petition for PCR and, two, if the circuit court grants PCR. There's a -1 amendment to House Bill 2133, which deletes the provision relating to a petitioner's duty to give notice to the district attorney.
We have Tim Sylvester from the Department of Justice. Mr. Sylvester.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Tim Sylvester from the Department of Justice. Speaking on behalf of this bill, this is a bill that we have proposed. What it does, as was mentioned by committee counsel, it does essentially three things. It makes three small changes to the Post-Conviction Hearing Act that are simply designed to correct problems that we have under the Act, and we've been in consultation with the defense bar on this, and I think everybody agrees that these are appropriate things to do at this point. The primary purpose of this bill is to allow a petitioner who has defaulted in filing his notice of appeal within the 30-day limit to, under very narrow circumstances, file a delayed appeal. In years past, there is a similar statute in the code that allows a criminal defendant in a criminal action who defaults in filing his notice of appeal to obtain relief from the appellate court under similar circumstances. And in the past, we always assumed that same statute applied to post-conviction actions too. But in a case
you did hand out with a material on 2138.
I'll keep that one with you because that will be the next bill. Sorry about that.
Three and an eight don't look that much different.
Anyway, in a decision by the Court of Appeals called Felkel versus Thompson that's listed on the second page of my prepared testimony, the Court of Appeals held that that statute that applies to criminal cases does not apply to post-conviction cases. And as a result, there have been several cases over the years in which a post-conviction petitioner who filed an untimely notice of appeal has had his case dismissed. And that has created problems for us in a variety of ways. And basically, there's a basic unfairness to that, too, because typically a petitioner who files a notice of appeal is incarcerated and is relying on a court-appointed counsel. And if the court-appointed counsel is the one who neglects to file a notice of appeal and thereby deprives the petitioner of appellate review, there is nothing the petitioner can do about it. And so we have, in the past couple of years, been litigating cases in the Court of Appeals to see under what circumstances such a petitioner may be afforded relief. And we also are concerned that eventually, if that issue gets into the federal courts may impose some sort of escape clause too. And so in order to solve that particular problem that we have, we're proposing simply amending the Post-Conviction Hearing Act to very specifically allow for a delayed appeal under the same circumstances that a delayed appeal is granted in a criminal action. The second issue where there's a certain bit of uncertainty is in those circumstances in which a post-conviction court grants relief to the petitioner and the state seeks to appeal. It doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. And the question is, if the post-conviction court grants a post-conviction relief in the nature of, say, for example, a new trial and the state appeals, does the state's appeal automatically stay the judgment, the post-conviction court judgment, or not? The Post-Conviction Hearing Act is not clear on that point, and we've had some fights over the years about whether it does or not. We do not have a court decision on that. And what we decided was that it would be beneficial to all concerned simply to add a new provision that makes it very clear that when the state does appeal from a post-conviction judgment, that the appeal does stay the effectiveness of the judgment pending the appeal, but that the petitioner in those circumstances may seek relief from the post-conviction court in the nature of release pending appeal. And like I said, we talked that over with the defense bar, and that is fine with both of us. The final point is just another simple clarification, and this requires a little bit of explanation. When a defendant is convicted in one county and is sent off to prison, if he then files a petition for post-conviction relief, you do not file it in the county, necessarily in the county in which you were convicted. Rather, you file your petition in the county in which you are incarcerated. And the defendant in a post-conviction action, well, the criminal defendant becomes the petitioner, and then the person who defends the post-conviction action is the state, is the Department of Justice, rather than the original district attorney. And so, for example, if someone gets convicted in Lane County of a crime and is sent off to Marion County to prison, and then he files a petition for post-conviction relief, he will file his petition in Marion County, and we, not the district attorney, will defend it. Well, that does create problems in those situations where the court does grant relief, because the original trial court is not aware of that, and the original district attorney is not aware of that, necessarily, unless we keep the DA apprised. And so there is some concern about if the, for one reason or another, the post-conviction judgment is not filed back in the original trial court, we have had some problems over the years in getting those judgments enforced. And so the third provision in this bill that this bill would do is would require a petitioner who has obtained post-conviction relief to take that judgment and go back to the original trial court and file that judgment in the original trial court and provide notice of that judgment to the district attorney, and so that both the original trial court and the district attorney are aware that the post-conviction judgment has modified the original judgment. And at that point, the judgment becomes effective. That is simply a ministerial task, but we believe that it is one that is necessary for proper functioning of the system. And again, as I mentioned, we talked to the defense bar about that, and as I understand, they have no objection to that provision. One thing I do want to point out is that we do currently have a couple of cases on appeal in which a petitioner in a post-conviction action failed to file a timely notice of appeal, and those cases currently are in the Court of Appeals, and under the Felkel versus Thompson case, the Court of Appeals will be obliged to dismiss those appeals. It is our belief and it is our intention that when this bill is enacted, it will be effective to and apply to any pending appeals in that posture. And I don't have a provision in this bill for that, but I believe from my understanding of the case law that a bill such as this that is enacted while an appeal is pending will affect and essentially make that appeal effective under the current provisions. Unless the committee has other questions, that's all I have right now.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvester. It may be helpful for the committee just to summarize the relationship between post-conviction relief and an appeal from an error committed by the trial court, because that's not maybe an intuitively logical or obvious distinction.
Well, Chairman McPherson, basically the way a post-conviction case and an appeal interrelate is this. When a defendant is convicted in the trial court for some crime and the court imposes sentence, the defendant can appeal to the Court of Appeals in the ordinary course. And in the course of that appeal, the person that can complain about any errors that may have happened during the course of the trial that are on the face of the record, so that if he objected to evidence and the trial court overruled that objection and the evidence came in, you can challenge that issue on appeal. Or, you know, if the court imposed a sentence that you didn't like, you can raise that on appeal. But in the course of a criminal case, there are a lot of potential errors that happen in the course of the trial that may not be apparent on the face of the record. And so those are not issues that can be raised on direct appeal. And so once the appeal is finalized and the Court of Appeals affirms the underlying judgment, then the defendant can go in and file a post-conviction proceeding to raise any claim that he could not have raised on direct appeal. And the typical claim that you would raise in that context is a claim that your court-appointed counsel did not provide constitutionally adequate assistance. That is not a claim that you can raise on direct appeal because there is no basis for an appellate court to review such a claim. And so, at least in that record. And so in a post-conviction action, what the defendant, as the petitioner, will do is say, my counsel, for example, should have gone out and found this witness. And here is this witness now who could have provided exculpatory evidence. Or my counsel should have moved to suppress my confession. He didn't do that, and so now I want my confession suppressed. And so the Post-Conviction Hearing Act is a means by which a defendant who, particularly one who had court-appointed counsel, can have a court review the adequacy of his counsel's performance during the underlying criminal prosecution. I can tell you that the vast majority of those cases ultimately are rejected. There's only a few cases every year in which a post-conviction court actually does grant post-conviction relief, but it is a necessary part of the process in order to ensure that somebody who's convicted of a crime was convicted in a fair proceeding and was given adequate counsel. Does that answer your question?
It does, and something that wouldn't it be sort of intuitively obvious is that this is oftentimes, you know, maybe months or even years down the road from when the original conviction occurred, because these are not going to what happened at the trial, other than say whether the assistance of counsel was so ineffectual as to fall below a constitutional standard. But a person who's convicted may take an appeal based on errors committed in the trial, carry those through, and if they lose, say, months or a year or two later, then bring a post-conviction relief proceeding. And what this bill goes to is what happens when mechanically about initiating a post-conviction relief effort and excusing certain kinds of lateness in initiating that process, and then the notice process by which people then who gets notified successful post-conviction relief petition has been submitted. That those are the items that are being covered here.
Correct, Chairman McPherson. And I do want to say that these proposed amendments to the Post-Conviction Hearing Act are designed simply to make the process more efficient. It is kind of neutral as opposed to providing an advantage to petitioners or providing an advantage to the state. Rather, these are simply designed as a way to make the whole process work a little bit smoother.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. Quick question, Mr. Sylvester. In regard to the post-conviction relief, your comments addressed perhaps some lack of counsel for the defendant. Is there ever an indication that perhaps there would have been error on the judges?
Representative Flores, Yes, a petitioner in a post-conviction proceeding may also complain about a variety of other things. For example, if the prosecution withheld exculpatory evidence, that is not something that could have been raised on the direct appeal because you didn't have that evidence at the time. That is something that you can raise in the Post-Conviction Hearing Act. If the trial court committed some error during the course of the trial, or you believe it committed some error during the course of the trial that is not otherwise apparent on the face of the original trial court record, yes, that is. For example, I think we had a case once where the trial judge during a recess went back and had some conversations with the jurors. That was not something that was on the face of the record. The defendant didn't know about that during the course of the trial, so it could not have been raised on direct appeal. But he did find out about it later, and he filed a post-conviction action in which he complained about the action of the trial court. And so, yes, in those circumstances in which the trial court may have committed some error that was not readily apparent and could not have been raised on direct appeal, that is a possible claim for post-conviction relief.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Sylvester. Why don't you remain there because you have the next bill up, and there's nobody else.
And I've already passed out my material.
All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2133 and open a work session on House Bill 2133. Committee, I think we got a good summary there from Mr. Sylvester. This is a technical bill that kind of neutral in its impacts, but to enhance the efficiency with which post-conviction relief proceedings are handled. And we do have the Dash 1 amendments here in the packet.
Mr. Chair, move the Dash 1 amendments adopted into House Bill 2133.
Representative Cameron moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2133. Any discussion? Any objection? And the Dash 1 amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2133 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2133 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Cox.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisman.
Excused.
Chairman
Person. Aye. House Bill 2133 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I guess the question, committee, is whether we think that this subject matter needs a presentation on the House floor. It does, on its surface, it reflects relief from late filing for a petition. And so maybe that bears some explanation.
I would agree with that, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I'll carry it.
Representative Krieger, thank you very much. Okay, I'll close the work session on House Bill 2133 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2138. Council Disco.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2138 relates to the pretrial release of certain defendants. Article 1, Section 43.1b of the Oregon Constitution requires courts to base pretrial release decisions on the, quote, reasonable protection of the victim and the public, close quote, in addition to the likelihood that the defendant will appear for trial. In relevant part, the Constitution states that there should be no bail for, quote, violent felonies, close quote, if the court determines that, one, there is probable cause that the defendant committed the crime, and two, there is clear and convincing evidence that releasing the defendant presents a danger to the victim or the public. ORS 135.240 is a statute that also addresses the pretrial release of defendants. Presently, its provisions appear to conflict with the Oregon constitutional provision I previously quoted in at least two ways. The Constitution addresses release for any violent felony, but the statute applies only to 19 specific felonies, and does not include felonies such as third-degree assault, third-degree rape, assaulting a public safety officer, intimidation, or encouraging sexual abuse of a child. Also, the Constitution establishes a narrower standard of review for a court to decide whether to release a defendant. The question in the Constitution is whether the defendant poses a danger of physical injury or sexual victimization to the public. The statute's standard is broader. whether the defendant will commit any new criminal offenses. House Bill 2138 attempts to reconcile the statute with the Constitution. It adopts the constitutional phrase violent felony, which it defines as a felony involving actual or threatened serious physical injury to the victim or a felony sexual offense. Under House Bill 2138, the court should deny pretrial release of a defendant charged with a violent felony if, one, there is probable cause to believe that the defendant committed the crime, and, two, there is clear and convincing evidence that, if released, the defendant poses a danger of physical injury or sexual victimization to the victim or to the public.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sylvester.
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, Tim Sylvester, Department of Justice, Appellate Division. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2138. At the very outset, I want to make clear that the sole purpose of this bill is simply to conform the current statute to the requirements of Article 1, Section 43. This requires a little bit of explanation how we got ourselves into this pickle. Way back, I think in 1995, the ballot measure 40 was enacted by the voters. It was a victims' rights measure that contained a variety of different provisions. One of the provisions in the ballot measure 40 restricted pretrial release. And as a result of the enactment of ballot measure 40 as a constitutional provision, the legislature in 1997 enacted Senate Bill 936 that went through and made a bunch of changes to the criminal code in order to conform the criminal code to ballot measure 40. And so ORS 135-240 was amended at that time to conform to ballot measure 40. After that was done, however, the Oregon Supreme Court, in a case called Armada versus Kitzhaber, which is cited on the first page of my prepared testimony, struck down ballot measure 40 and said that it had been submitted to the voters erroneously because it had too many constitutional provisions in one measure. And as a result of that, the constitutional underpinning for 135-240 was eliminated. And then in a subsequent case called State versus Sutherland, the Oregon Supreme Court said that ORS 135-240, as it had been enacted, was no longer enforceable because it conflicted with other provisions of the Oregon Constitution. Shortly after Sutherland was decided by the Oregon Supreme Court, however, the various provisions of ballot measure 40 were chopped up and then resubmitted to the voters in a variety of separate ballot measures, and one of those was actually approved by the voters as a victims' rights initiative, and that was became Article 1, Section 43. Well, the problem was that and Article 1, Section 43 reenacted as a piece of constitutional law the restrictions on pretrial release in the case of a violent felony. Well, the problem was that when the provision was resubmitted to the voters, the proponents of the measure changed the standard that was set out in that from the standard that had been set out in ballot measure 40. And so when Article 1, Section 43 was enacted in 1999, in its current form, the ORS 135-240, the provisions of that statute do not conform with the current Article 1, Section 43. Even though that was done in 1999, for the last 8 years we've been operating with a statute that is out of sync with the Constitution, and that has created a bit of problem in the trial courts because they're not sure which statute applies and where the Constitution applies. Well, this is a situation where it is at least very clear to us in the Department of Justice that obviously the Article 1, Section 43, the standard set out in the constitutional provision, which again I hasten to point out, is a victims' rights initiative, and so this is what the victims' rights group wanted, and this is what is now part of our Constitution. And so to the extent that there is a conflict between the statute and the Constitution, I think we owe it to the voters to make sure that our statutes conform to the Constitution. And so we drafted House Bill 2138 with the intent that it simply codify what is in Article 1, Section 43 and do no more. And so this will ensure that the statutory provisions that are set out that govern pretrial release conform 100% to the constitutional provision, don't require anything more, don't require anything less. And so in that respect, we consider that it's merely housekeeping and does not affect any substantive change in Oregon law except to correct that current misalignment between the statute and the Constitution. Unless the committee has other questions, that's all I have.
Are there any questions for Mr. Sylvester? Thank you very much, Mr. Sylvester. Why don't you stay there? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2138 and open a work session on House Bill 2138. Committee, I think you heard the presentation, which indicates that we're really just aligning our Constitution with the statute with our constitutional provision now on pretrial release.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2138 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2138 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici.
Aye. Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Trump.
Aye.
Representative
Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Breese.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Resnick.
Excused.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 2138 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Barker, would you be willing to carry that?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'll now close the work session of House Bill 2138. Thank you, Mr. Sylvester. Committee, the rest of our agenda is in work sessions, and I'm going to begin by opening a work session on House Bill 2127. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. House Bill 2127 discusses juvenile code and also talks about the constitutional rights of crime victims. Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Sections 42 and 43, articulates the rights of crime victims during all stages of criminal prosecutions, both adult and juvenile. Generally, such rights can include, one, the right to be present at and timely notified of critical events, two, to obtain various information about a defendant's status, three, to refuse to speak with or to provide certain information to an agent of the defendant, four, to prompt restitution, five, to transcripts of proceedings, six, to be consulted about plea negotiations involving violent felonies, seven, to be reasonably protected from the defendant during the prosecution, and eight, to have pretrial release decisions based in part on the reasonable protection of the victim. House Bill 2127 revises the juvenile code to be consistent with these constitutional rights, and in some cases it also provides an additional clarification. The more substantive of these additional clarifications include the following. One, absent good cause, a victim need not reveal the victim's address or phone number to the defendant. Two, if a defendant's agent contacts the victim, the agent must reveal the agent's identity, that the victim need not speak with the agent, and that the victim may have an agent of the state present if the victim elects to do so. Three, any pre-adjudication release of a juvenile defendant must include a no contact with the victim order. Four, the victim must be consulted regarding a juvenile defendant's entry into diversion programs. And five, a court may not release a juvenile awaiting adjudication if the charge involves a violent felony or if the juvenile poses a danger of serious physical injury or sexual victimization to the victim or public. There is a dash one amendment to House Bill 2127, which specifies that the district attorney or the juvenile department must make reasonable efforts to notify the victim about certain proceedings. And it also, then, the dash one amendment includes certain provisions relating to authorized diversion programs.
It's been a long time since this bill was before us for hearing, a couple of months, and so it's that kind of goes back to early in our process. Council, just refresh me. Were there policy choices involved in the dash one amendments, or was this a technical cleanup of things that were just identified by our witnesses?
Chair McPherson, I don't believe that there were any major policy impacts in the dash one amendment. There might be a little, if necessary, for clarification on what's happened between when we originally heard this bill, January 24th to today, you might ask Ms. Shankle to provide a brief summary, if necessary. There's been a lot of my understanding is there's been a lot of discussion about this, and it's okay, and it's present form by all the parties.
Okay,
I'm reading sign language.
High sign that the this is a consensus product.
I have a question. During the testimony earlier, the Juvenile Rights Project brought up a couple of concerns, and I wondered if they were involved at all in the drafting of amendments, if they were involved in the process.
Representative Bonamici, my message from Ms. Shankle is yes, they were.
Three blanks mean yes, and two blanks.
Like
Ms. Shankle, why don't you come forward and describe the process by which the Dash 1 amendments evolved? This has been quite a while since this bill was before us, so if we could do a little further updating, may be helpful.
Certainly. Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ron L. Shankle with the Department of Justice. Darian has done a fine job of describing what's in this bill. And in response to Representative Bonamici's question, where we left off in January, you heard testimony from the Attorney General himself, one of our attorneys, and several other players. We knew that we needed one more meeting that Hardy facilitated in order to do these consensus amendments, which you have before you today. Let me be clear, they don't completely alleviate some of the concerns that were raised by the Juvenile Rights Project, but I believe that they, well, I don't believe, I know that they're aware of the amendments, they've seen them, they have not commented any further, so we are calling these consensus amendments, and as Mr. Stanford said, the intent here is to repeat the constitutional provisions in the juvenile code, and in some areas simply to give a little more clarity on how the process works, but there is no intended policy change.
Any questions for Ms. Shankle? Thank you very much.
I'd just like to say one thing that was brought up in this, where the agent of the defense would have to identify themselves when they if they contact the victim, and I think that's important. I've seen in the past many times when somebody will come out and say they're from the DA's office and get a victim to to talk to them when they're from the defense attorney's office, which is, of course, could be called the DA's office, but it's very misleading, and that's why they do it. And so this will correct that problem.
If there's no further discussion, do we have a motion on the Dash 1 amendments?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1s into House Bill 2127.
Representative Barker moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2127. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The Dash 1 amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2127 to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2127 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
I'll be supporting this, but I wanted to reserve there may be a possibility I'll change my vote if I find that. I mean, I just got the amendments, and if I find that some of the concerns that were raised are still concerns. So, but based on the statement that they were consensus amendments and there's nobody here opposing them, I will vote yes.
Thank you.
House Bill 2127 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Reed, you haven't carried very many bills from our committee to the floor. Would you be willing to take this one on?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Close the work session on House Bill 2127. And open a work session on House Bill 2333.
Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. House Bill 2333 relates to sex offender registration for certain persons convicted of certain sex offenses. ORS 181.595 and ORS 181.596 require certain persons convicted of sex crimes to maintain lifetime sex offender registration in Oregon. There is presently a mechanism for relief from this requirement at ORS 181.600. House Bill 2333 revises Oregon's sex offender reporting requirements for specific crimes. Originally, in the original bill, those crimes included rape, second degree and third degree, sodomy, second degree and third degree, sex abuse, first, second, and third degree, and contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor. The House Bill 2333 in its original form would apply to persons that were convicted of one of those crimes or the attempted version of those crimes. Two, that were found guilty, except for insanity, of one of those crimes. Three, who committed one of the listed crimes and was under the juvenile court jurisdiction. Or four, who was convicted in another state of one of those crimes. If any of the above four conditions were met, then under the original version of House Bill 23, that person need not report as a sex offender if each of the following is true. One, the person is less than 10 years older than the victim. Two, the victim's lack of consent was solely due to age. And three, at the time of the offense, the person had no prior adult or juvenile conviction for most sex-related crimes. There is a dash one amendment to House Bill 23 that significantly narrows the scope. I'll note for the record, there was a work group that met to discuss House Bill 2333. This amendment, I think, could not be characterized fairly as a consensus amendment because there was disagreement among the parties. But nonetheless, this is what the dash one amendment would do. The dash one amendment to House Bill 2333 specifically lists the crimes that the bill applies to, and it would only apply to the following: rape 3, sodomy 3, sexual abuse 3, contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor, sexual misconduct, or the attempt versions of any of these crimes. Second major thing that the amendments do is it narrows the scope of the bill to apply only to persons, defendants, that are less than 5 years older than the than the victim. The original bill said 10 years. The amended version says 5 year age difference. Finally, it narrows the scope of the bill to apply only when the victim is age 14 or older. And it would apply both to persons who are convicted in the future and relieve them of the duty to report, or for persons who are presently having to report, they would no longer have to report under the version House Bill 2333.
Thank you, Council. And just to remind the committee, since it's been a while since this bill was before us, this bill does not go to the criminality of the conduct. It goes only to whether the perpetrator, the offender who's been convicted, is subject to mandatory sex abuse or sex offender registration. So it doesn't go to criminal penalties, and it's been council, just going on memory, within a three-year age difference, there's no crime. So really the impact here is on those events that occur between parties who are between 3 years and 5 years difference in age.
That's correct. There is a specific exemption in Oregon law that allows for, I believe it's an affirmative defense if a defendant is less than 3 years older than the victim. And again, something, a point to be made about this bill is this only applies to the extent that the age of consent is the only consent issue. If there's any kind of force or compulsion at all, this is out.
And so that's the effect of these specifically listed offenses that are in the dash one amendments, is that those are ones where there's no forcibility or violence in connection with it, where purely a matter of inability to give consent.
That is generally correct, yes.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, just to clarify, inability to consent means that there was consent, but the person wasn't of age.
Right. Representative Cameron, that's correct. The law says you cannot consent when you're 13.
And you may recall, committee, there was an offender who was at the hearing here, and this was up before, as I recall the facts of that case, this would apply to that individual, and the effect of this bill would be to relieve him of further sex offender registration.
I just wanted to add, that was Matthew Shettles and his mother, Ann, who are my constituents, who were here. And you're exactly right, that because he had just turned 18, and it was his high school girlfriend, and she was almost 15. And so it's that situation that I hope this bill addresses, because it was consensual, and they were, high school students, boyfriend, girlfriend. But then a mandatory reporter found out about that they had sex on the his high school graduation evening, and they came in and we heard from their story about what that has meant to his ability to be a contributing member to society, and So I'm glad we have this bill, and I'm glad it addresses that situation.
Representative Krieger.
Sure. You know, we spent a lot of time working on this, trying to find something that was justice, and Representative Bonamici has talked about these boys, and usually it's the boys, at, you know, that age class. But you're talking 2 years. They still are going to be convicted. They still will be on parole and probation, where they can receive counseling if the court or, you know, their probation officer deems it necessary. And time and time again, I have heard that these young people, the first thing that a problem that develops is they can't get a job. When you can't get a job and you graduate, maybe you can't even get into a higher education. And as a result of that, we're probably going to cause more crime, serious crime, the way these people end up going, because they're not giving an opportunity. And it's only the first time that they commit this type of a violation. You're talking only about a two-year class. You're only talking about not having to register. Everything else is the same.
Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. And I totally support where this bill is going, but I just had a question for counsel. So one way to flip this for the age of 14, so once you're 14, you know what you're doing? you know, how did you reach the age of 14 rather than 13? You know, for...
That may not be a fair question for counsel, since he's sort of the technical advisor, but...
I have no opinions.
Okay. That's wise yeah. answer.
What's strange, Mr. Chair, is... You can take this young man who's 2 years and 9 months, and he can start being promiscuous clear back and intentionally have multiple affairs per week with multiple girls, and he's not violation or held accountable for anything.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, there's got to be some fairness and justice here. You know, we got this date, and we got to have something as a hard line, but having this only two-year gap in there that they wouldn't have to register, and if they are the type of person who's going to continue after the first violation, they've been given an opportunity, regardless whether they're registered or not registered, isn't going to be the difference whether or not they're going to commit the crime again. In fact, if they found out that they don't have to register, it would be an incentive not to commit the crime again.
Well, and Representative Krieger, I totally agree where you're at. I was just wondering, you know, is the last line, the victim was at least 14 years of age.
Well, maybe that comes from down in the south of Tennessee where the Ridge Runners were chasing their sisters. I don't know.
Well, 13's bad luck, that's why.
Well, I mean, and I understand it's just there, yeah. But I was just wondering if there was any research, you know, psychological or sociological.
I think that 14, that applies to the victim. And
right.
A victim below 14... it has to be a policy choice that maybe that's so egregious that they have to keep reporting.
Now that I understand.
That's probably more the basis for it.
Yeah, because I totally concur with the rest of the bill. I was just wondering how that last line got there.
Okay.
So if there are any further comments or questions, if not, is there a motion on the Dash 1 amendments?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2333.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2333. Any discussion? Any objection? And the Dash 1 amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2333 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2333 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative
Cameron.
Aye. Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Cobb.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett.
Aye.
House Bill 2333 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Krieger, would you carry that on the floor?
Would like to.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your work on this bill. Close the work session on House Bill 2333 and open a work session on House Bill 2508.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, House Bill 2508 relates to red light cameras. ORS 810.434 allows cities with populations over 30,000 and the city of Newburgh to install and operate red light cameras at the city's expense. Presently, Portland is limited to no more than 12 cameras. House Bill 2508 amends ORS 810.434 by lowering the threshold population from 30,000 to 10,000 and by eliminating the specific Newburgh exception. Since Newburgh's population is approximately 20,000, it would be covered by the amendment automatically. There are four amendments to House Bill 2508 that are before the committee. The Dash 1 amendment eliminates the limitation on the number of intersections in which a city can install cameras. And again, there are presently, there's a limitation of 12 for the city of Portland and 8 for everywhere else. And I should clarify, there's not a limitation on the number of cameras. You can have many cameras at a particular intersection. The limitation is the number of intersections in which you can install cameras. Right now it's 12 for Portland, 8 for any other city. The Dash 1 amendment eliminates those limitations. The second amendment, the Dash 2, raises the limitation on the number of intersections in which Portland can install cameras from the present 12 to 24. It leaves the 8 limitation for other jurisdictions. The Dash 3 amendment eliminates a requirement that the Oregon Department of Transportation provide a report to the legislature on this entire process. And if you recall, I believe there was testimony that ODOT was basically summarizing what everybody else was saying, which was kind of passing paper on, and the report wasn't anything substantive in and of itself. That was the motivation for the Dash 3. The Dash 4 amendment then eliminates any population threshold necessary for a city to install a camera. Again, present law says 30,000. The bill in its original form proposes 10,000. This eliminates that population threshold altogether. That's the Dash 4 amendment.
Okay. Barker. If I could understand this then, so if we did the Dash 1, we would eliminate, we would, cities of any population could go with, or I'm sorry, Portland could go with as many camera or intersections as they wanted, and Dash 4 deletes the 10,000. So in other words, if we did the 1 and the 4, cities could do install as many as they wanted, and just from a practical point of view, because of the cost of, to set those up, they won't be going up all over the place. They'll be few and far between. But this way, we're not discriminating against a smaller city who might have a problem and wish to put one in.
Representative Barker, that's correct. The Dash 1 in combination with the Dash 4 would basically say as many intersections as you want in whatever city or town that you want to put them in.
So in terms of policy choices, so the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s are mutually exclusive.
Correct.
Because it's an increase in the number of cameras that Portland can operate or removing the limitation on number of intersections at which cameras can be located entirely. The Dash 3 amendments are independent because that relates to this reporting requirement for the ODOT to report back to the legislature. And the Dash 4 amendments are independent of all the others because it goes strictly to the size question. As we now, the original thrust of the bill is to go from 30,000 down to 10,000, but the Dash 4s would eliminate the 10,000 threshold and say anyone can do it.
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Barker.
I'll propose something, then we could discuss it. I would move the Dash 1s and the Dash 4s. And, I'm sorry, 1, 3, and 4.
Yeah, 1, 3, and 4.
Eliminate the what seems to be extra reporting duties that doesn't make any sense. And I'll leave out Dash 2s because that conflicts with the others.
Right. Representative Barker moves the Dash 1 amendments, the Dash 3 amendments, and the Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 2508. Let's have a discussion.
I have a question. And maybe Council can answer this. I think probably the reason for the original report from DOT was to provide some oversight. And without that, where does the oversight come from to make sure that the cameras are calibrated correctly and that sort of thing. Does it come from the local jurisdiction?
Representative Bonamici, yes. I think what I would I would direct your attention, just looking at the statute, to 810.434.4b, and it's got by March 1st of the year of each regular session, the Legislative Assembly, it says ODOT shall provide a report, but then it says, and each city that operates a camera shall present the report. My recollection of the original testimony is that what was happening where the cities were providing their report, and ODOT was basically cutting and pasting that same report and giving it to the legislature.
So does the amendment just take out the DOT section, not the paragraph B?
Yes.
All right.
Just the duplicate report.
So we'd still be getting a report from each city that's conducting photo red light operations. And there's a separate statute, I believe, on photo radar, so that none of these changes would impact that piece of technology.
That's correct.
Any further discussion?
This is Bill. Representative Jensen will be able to support since we took out the population.
That's right. I'm wondering how many lighted intersections there are in cities. Well, probably a fair number in under 10,000. Although that you get down to the smaller cities, there aren't that many.
Mr. Chair, we have got a total, I think, of 5 or 6 red lights in Curry County.
It's going to open up a whole new opportunity for public safety down in Curry County.
The town I like to spend my winters in California does not have a signal in town yet, so which is very nice.
Okay, if there is there any further discussion of the motion, which is to move the -1 amendments, the -3 amendments, and the -4 amendments into the bill?
From a policy standpoint, I don't see any difference between the size of the city. That doesn't make sense to me. I just hope that the cities are giving some oversight to these, whatever jurisdiction, to make sure that they're operating properly and not
the citizens will let them know.
Yeah, we will hear about that.
I know there's been some controversy, for example, in Portland about the company that Portland is contracted with, and they're allegedly illegal activities in other states and that kind of thing.
Other countries, not other states.
Well,
even. Yeah. So
I just hope that the local jurisdictions are monitoring.
Right. Thank you. Good point.
If there's no further discussion, is there any objection to moving the -1, -3, and -4 amendments into House Bill 2508? If not, though, all three of those amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2508 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2508 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one of the blessings and or cursings of getting information that we have is that we do get information that we have the responsibility to review and analyze. And I know I've heard from quite a few folks, both my in-district constituents as well as constituents from across the state, who are just steadfastly opposed to red light cameras and so on. And they don't have the benefit, however, of looking at the information and the accident rates and the injury rates. So I will be supporting this bill, but I just felt it was my responsibility to express their concerns and address the fact that there is more to this story than it appears on its face. And I think we've done a good job in listening and making that review and analysis.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Flores. Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I think, you know, being an ex-officer out there, I see more of this type of activity and data seems to be increasing. And it's not people just sneaking through the light. They're going through the light at 30 miles an hour or 40 because they're speeded up to get through the yellow. And they're creating a hazard. Mm-hmm. And I would say it's a fairly small percentage of the population. Mm-hmm. But here in Salem, as I drive around, I made this comment. As we go, you have to change lanes. You're trying to get out of a parking lot. People seem to be very courteous about that. But it's this one segment of people that are very disrespectful about these intersections. I guess they're in a big hurry. But I think this is is needed, and it's needed everywhere. And I think it's going to slow people down, and it's going to cause fewer accidents.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
I share Representative Flores' concerns about the constituency. I've heard from some people, mostly people who have received tickets from the Florida Red Line, who are concerned about it, and again, want to reiterate my concerns that I hope that they're calibrated properly and used properly, and that if people do in fact have a defense, they can find counsel to help them assert that. But I will support the bill.
Okay. There's no further discussion. The clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Kahn.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 2508 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who feel a particular affinity? Okay, Representative Barker, that'd be great. Thank you very much. Terrific. We're going to close the work session at House Bill 2508, but we do have one item of business to attend to here. We moved House Bills 2133 and 2138. I'm going to reopen the work session on each of those bills for the purpose of requesting a suspension of the rules so that Representative Wisnant can vote on those bills. Is there any objection to that suspension of the rules? If not, so ordered. Representative Wisnant, how do you vote on each of House Bill 2133 and 2138?
Aye and aye.
Very good. Thank you very much. I'll reclose the work session on those two bills. That concludes our agenda. We're adjourned.